Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 154 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling Gut Check, How Bread Boosts Our Microbiome. About my conversation with Corey Wisner, Assistant Professor of Nutrition at Arizona State University. I first heard Wisner speak about the microbiome at a Wheat Foods Council meeting I attended 2 years ago in Scottsdale, Arizona, not far from Phoenix, where Wisner works. I was hooked. If you're not familiar with the term microbiome and how wheat is involved, bear with me for a moment. Our microbiome, and we all have one, is the name for the collection of all the microorganisms that live within and on us. These trillions of microorganisms, which are not part of our human genome, have colonized different parts of our bodies. Nowhere are they more abundant and diverse than within our intestines. The Wheat Foods Council was interested in Wisner's research because it appears to show that far from being something people should avoid, bread is actually a food that optimizes the microbiome. And as you'll hear ahead, there are all sorts of benefits that come from having a healthy gut biome, benefits that are far removed from the gut itself. It's fascinating research that I think the major bread brands here and around the world should embrace to figure out how to communicate this benefit to customers. Wisner was invited to the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention to present on a new type of barley from Ardent Mills called Sustagrain. It's a food-type barley that imparts far more fiber than the usual suspects, and Wisner was investigating it as a rice extender, both for fiber and other health benefits. As valuable as the barley research is, however, I wanted to talk to Wisner about the microbiome because of her findings that the same bread products demonized by books like Wheat Belly and Grain Brain are really among the best foods we have for feeding our microbiome, which may have to do with the fact that we've been priming our gut with grains for almost 20,000 years. In my book, that's a long time to get accustomed to a particular diet. I spoke to Wisner November 15, 2019, in a hallway of the Grand Hotel in downtown Spokane, where the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention was taking place. I'm going to warn you here that we'll be talking a bit about poop, because it's through fecal matter that Wisner measures the communities of microorganisms within our guts. Perhaps she was raised with brothers, I didn't ask, but when it comes to working with poop, well, let me put it this way. When I ask if there was ever a time she was squeamish around her samples, she just laughed.
Surprisingly, no. So in my graduate career, that's kind of when I had my first foray into the gut microbiome. And I didn't actually start there. I started in the area of mineral metabolism, specifically calcium during the adolescent growth spurt. And so one of the ways that you can study calcium metabolism is to measure everything that goes in. And the only way to know what stays is if you measure everything that comes out, both urine and feces. And so to be honest, feces is way better than urine. Urine, you get the phantom pee smell. It sticks with you for days. So feces, it's like in the lab and out, and then it's over. So it's not as bad as it sounds.
All right. Tell me just a little bit about the microbiome in general and its size, scope, and more specifically, talk about the gut microbiome and its importance.
So the microbiome is a collection of microbes that live in and on our body. So we actually have microbes on every surface of our body, our skin, in our nose, our mouth, and the intestines is actually a fascinating area because in the intestine, that's where we have more bacteria per unit of space than any other bodily location that we have. And so when you think about humans, we express proteins by turning on and off genes, and we have 23,000 genes that we can express. But our microbiome, this collective of fungi, archaea, bacteria, they express 3.3 million genes. And so when you think about that, and they're living in our gut, we're actually highly dependent on the metabolic reactions that they're carrying out with those genes. So, and, you know, we've ignored them, but they've always been there, and they've always been helping us.
Mm-hmm. Now, is the gut a particularly popular place for these microorganisms you're talking about?
It is. In fact, the intestine has more microbes than any other body location, as I mentioned, and the diversity of that community is far more rich than any of the other bodily locations. So you have more than 1,000 different unique species, and then they're wielding all of their unique genes to express different metabolic reactions for us.
And when you say metabolic reactions, what are you speaking of specifically?
So they do many different things. So every day we are exposed to nutrients that we purposely consume. We're also exposed to toxins from the environment. And so they'll process toxins away into less volatile things that can't hurt us. And they take nutrients from our diet that we can't digest and use for health benefits. And so a perfect example is dietary fiber. We don't have enzymes to break down dietary fiber, but our gut microbes do. And so when they do that, they convert them into something called short-chain fatty acids, which are the primary fuel source for our intestinal cells, so it keeps our gut healthy. And I think of the gut as sort of a window to the rest of our body, and so it's communicating with every other organ. And so once those short-chain fatty acids pass through into the blood, they can go and lower our blood pressure, improve vascular function, lower our glucose spikes after eating a sugar-rich meal, all sorts of different things.
Right. All right. Now, scientists have known about these microorganisms, I found in my research, since about the 1880s, but it's sort of like they just came on the scene in 2007 or so. Why suddenly is there all this interest in the microbiome where we knew that was sort of there for 100 years?
That's a good question, and one that does have a pretty simplistic explanation. So, like you said, we've known that we've had microbes sharing our body space for a long time. And one of the biggest challenges with studying microbes is that many of them live in anaerobic environments, meaning that they cannot have oxygen present. And our gut is one particular location where we definitely don't have a lot of oxygen. And so when we historically were measuring the presence of microbes, we would have to culture the bacteria on an auger plate and then incubate it in an incubator. And we were only able to probably actually culture about 20% of all the microbes that really live in our gut. And so in the early 2000s, new technology became available in genetic sequencing that allowed us to basically collect a fecal sample, and we can sequence every microbe that's there based on the genes that are inside of the cells. And so then we were able to now identify that other 80% of microbes that otherwise we had never been able to explore before.
Okay, so we essentially have trillions of these microorganisms, okay? Trillions, folks. We're essential to their survival. Are they essential for our survival?
Yes, very much so. While we are providing them a safe place to live, we receive a benefit, so I would call it a symbiotic relationship where we're both getting benefits. So they process a lot of nutritional components that we can't process ourselves with our 23,000 genes. And so by having their extra set of proteins to carry out all sorts of metabolic reactions, we actually benefit health-wise. Microbial actions have been shown to alter our immune system. They communicate with our brain so that we feel happier. They communicate with our heart tissue and our pancreas so that we don't release too much insulin. So all sorts of different things that we're benefiting from their presence with.
Are we born with a microbiome?
Ooh, this is a hotly debated topic. So there's conflicting information about whether or not there are microbes within our uterine environment when we're developing as a baby. And one of the most interesting things is that some scientists have found very small amounts of microbes in the amniotic fluid, which is the fluid that surrounds a developing fetus. And the major first inoculation of bacteria is when you're delivered. So the vaginal canal of a female is actually populated with acid-producing bacteria, bifidobacteria, and lactobacillus. And those are really important for young infants because their gut isn't fully developed. So then as they come through the birth canal, their mouth is kind of filled with these bacteria. They swallow them and they take up residence in their intestine. And then what happens is those microbes produce acid, and then that acid prevents pathogen colonization in the infant while their gut is still developing.
Fascinating, fascinating. Now, how do our eating habits affect the gut microbiome?
Depending on where you live in the globe and different cultural foods that people eat, you'll see different microbes proliferate. So, for example, in Asian countries, they eat more seaweed than we do in the Western world. There are specific microbes that are capable of digesting seaweed components that we don't see in, say, an American gut. In America, we have a very Western diet that tends to be higher in fat, protein, and sugar. And so we tend to have a different community of bacteria. And I wouldn't say that they're worse than other things. It's all a balance at the lower level of resolution. So we can look at the phylo level, which is the highest level of resolution, and there are the Firmicutes and the Bacteroidetes. And then you can get down further to the genus and species level, where we can actually then associate one microbe with an independent function.
Is there a core group of microbes that everyone has?
This is also a hotly debated topic. Everyone has a really individualized microbiome. And so right now, if you were to give me a fecal sample and I knew it was yours, and then 6 months out, you and other people sent me samples, I would actually be able to identify you by your microbiome.
It's so specific. It's like my fingerprint.
Yep, exactly.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so what you were just saying, it sounds like somebody in Ethiopia, for instance, would have a different microbiome than myself, let's say.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So there's a really beautiful publication that came out around 2010 that compared a community of individuals who are what we call post-Neolithic. So the Neolithic boom was when grain agriculture became really common. And so that community in Africa and Burkina Faso is still eating grain-based diets, and they compared them to a group of children in Italy, and it's a location in Italy where they've actually have a westernization of their diet similar to in America, and the gut microbiome composition looks completely different. And in fact, that was the first paper that really showed that, or alluded to the idea that Firmicutes are bad because they're more prevalent in a Western diet compared to Bacteroidetes, which you see in the Burkina Faso population.
Okay, so on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being that we're just scratching the surface and 10 being that we know nearly everything there is to know, where is research on the gut microbiome?
I know, honestly, I think we might be at 1 to 2. It's such a new field, which is really exciting, but it means that there's still so much more to explore, which is great because that's job security for me. But because everyone is so individualized, in order to really understand how our behaviors interact with our individuality microbially, that's going to take time. And then I think once we have those answers, then we'll be closer to a 10.
Now, there were a couple of influential books published over the last decade which criticized gluten for a host of ills. Is it possible the real culprit wasn't gluten or wheat, but a misaligned gut biome?
I would agree with that. I think that's entirely possible. The demonization of gluten is an unfortunate thing that's happened. I think it's been attributed to changes in cultivars of wheat over time, and my understanding is actually that the gluten content of grain has not changed. If anything's changed, we've actually been able to create cultivars that have a better composition of really important, healthy types of dietary fiber. And so one of the things that people were associating wheat consumption with is GI distress. But that GI distress could be that we do such an abysmal job of getting dietary fiber in our diet that the reintroduction of that extra fiber from wheat could have had that initial adverse effect on the gut. And the more you eat it, the more you're going to acclimate. But I don't think that the problem is gluten, and that's just an unfortunate thing that the media has kind of run wild with.
Now, there was an excavation in Jordan that found 14,000-year-old flatbread baked on hearths. 14,000 years is a long time for our bodies to habituate to a particular diet. Did bread and our microbiome grow up together?
Absolutely, yes. They have been there since the dawn of time in our guts. And that time frame, grains have even been around longer than that. It's thought that people were even eating barley, for example, 17,000 years ago. And so grain has been around. And as we've evolved from hunter-gatherers into this post-Neolithic type community that does have agriculture, our gut has molded with us on that journey.
Mm-hmm. So it's possible that eating bread may be the best thing for our microbiome?
That's my personal take. I think that bread is actually a really great way to get grains in. I know that there's been a lot of negative media towards bread being this weight gain inducing food, and there are really no data to support that, unfortunately. What happens in research is that people try to group like foods together into a group, and bread has been victimized and grouped with high sugar, high fat foods. And that's not really fair because grains provide a sustained fuel source in the form of carbohydrates that still have fiber even in refined grains. It's less fiber, but it's still there. And not only do our cells prefer carbohydrate as their primary fuel source, so do our microbiome bugs.
Oh, when are you going to write a book?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I did just write a textbook for my students. So maybe someday I'll get around to that.
Well, I mean, yes, you need to go on Dr. Oz. Is it possible that family folklore, like eating chicken noodle soup when you're sick, for instance, actually has a basis in fact due to the chicken noodle's impact on our gut microbiome?
That's quite possible. I think there's a few things about chicken noodle soup. So there are the noodles, which will have complex starches that feed the microbiome so that they could have anti-inflammatory properties for us when we're ill. There's also salt, which is a natural antimicrobial, which kills pathogenic microbes. And there's a good protein source, and depending on how they make the broth, if it's a bone broth, would have a lot of vitamins and minerals in it as well, which are key for getting over an illness.
Okay, Christmas is coming up, and for the holidays, we eat a lot of stuff that we don't necessarily eat the rest of the year. Will that change our gut microbiome, and is that bad?
You know, no one has actually studied whether or not the microbiome changes during the holiday period. I would imagine that it does change, because if you change your diet on one day, within 24 hours, your microbiome has shifted its composition a little bit to adjust to what its new food source is. So I would say, you know, over the holidays, it's perfectly fine to indulge, but it's good to just remember moderation is important, and then trying to fit in some fiber, perhaps to counteract some of those higher sugar, higher fat items, could really be a good way to go.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's easy for me to understand that there's a relationship between our gut microbiome and having diarrhea, for instance. But one of the things that fascinated me as I was researching this podcast was how research has shown the gut microbiome impacts a whole host of human ailments. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, I think this goes back to the sheer number of genes that microbes have to express, and that, again, we are a symbiotic host with our microbiome. So we're both helping each other. And so when we feed our microbiome the right things, they want to keep their host healthy as well. And that means systemic health across the entire body. It could be mental health, heart health, glucose control, even gut health. So the microbiome has been emerging as a key player in our risk for colon cancer, for example.
And depression, I was so blown away by the fact that it can impact our mood.
Yeah, so one thing people don't often attribute to the gastrointestinal tract is that you actually have a really robust nervous system innervation of the GI tract. So of all the organs in our body, our gut is basically right next to our nervous system, and that has a direct route to our brain, which changes how we feel. So the gut, actually the microbes make serotonin, lots of it, and serotonin is sort of a feel-good hormone that's related to dopamine, and so then that can travel to our brain and allow us to feel good.
The gut makes serotonin?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I thought the brain made serotonin.
It does also, but the microbes can make it as well. Another interesting thing that just emerged in the literature is that even when we exercise, and so, you know, you get that lactic acid burn in your muscles where they start to hurt, there is a microbe in our gut that is able to pull lactate from the blood and metabolize it so that our muscles don't get sore and we can actually perform longer. So they're finding that certain microbes are more prevalent in Olympic athletes, and that could be also why they have the stamina and can go, because their microbiome is helping them do that.
And so exercise will change the microbiome.
Absolutely.
Just fascinating, fascinating. Okay, antibiotics are given to people to kill particular pathogenic microorganisms in our bodies. What happens to the gut microbiome in the process of taking antibiotics?
Well, antibiotics definitely put the hurt on your microbiome. So they don't wipe out everything, but they wipe out next to almost everything. And depending on how old you are, how quickly you recuperate from that can vary. So older individuals, it could take a year to get your microbiome back to what it was. And as you mentioned, antibiotics are critical for treating a number of conditions. Some debate that in the U.S., physicians tend to overprescribe antibiotics. And so I think that, you know, as consumers and people who want our families to be healthy, we have to think about, okay, is this just a common cold, or do I really have a bacterial infection? Because if it's a virus, antibiotics aren't going to do anything. And so we just have to be smarter and, you know, make sure we're eating the right things so that our microbes will prime our immune system better.
In terms of priming, would probiotics be recommended if after you had antibiotics?
Many physicians are recommending that, and I think that there is growing evidence that that is actually really supportive of trying to initiate colonization of a healthy microbiome after taking antibiotics. And so I think even taking it while you're on the antibiotic, although you're probably killing a lot of them, that could already just start you on that trajectory. And so I definitely think that could be supportive.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible that people are obese not because they eat too much, but rather because their gut microbiome has gone haywire?
It could be a combination of both. So there's some really interesting animal studies where if you have an obese individual and a healthy weight individual, and you take their feces and you feed it to germ-free animals, meaning that they were raised in a microbe-free environment, the animal that is receiving the obese microbiome becomes obese. So it takes on the physical properties of its host, and then the healthy one, normal weight.
Fascinating, fascinating. What about research looking at dieting from a gut microbiome point of view? Is that happening?
A little bit, but it's an area where we probably have a lot of room for expansion in our knowledge. We're learning more and more. So, for example, I could talk about individuals who are eating a gluten-free diet. There are a couple studies on that, and obviously that's sort of a persistent food trend. And a healthy individual who does not have celiac disease and does not require a gluten-free diet actually experiences greater proliferation of pathogenic microbes in their gut and increased inflammation. And so that diet may not be good for someone who doesn't require it medically.
All right, all right. So I've heard about basically poop transfusions to control certain diseases. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So those are basically microbial transfers, so fecal microbiota transfers. And these particular medical treatments, and that's important because there's this sort of black market on the internet where people are doing DIY fecal transplants. I would never recommend that. But that said, people who have sometimes C. difficile or H. pylori infections, which antibiotics are not able to treat. And so in those situations, you can actually sequester the microbes from a healthy person's feces and then give it to the person who's infected, and it can cure them basically overnight. It's so amazing, the capacity of just inoculating someone's gut with a healthy community of bacteria.
Okay. Okay. So you have a poop icon that you use in your talks that is basically a steaming pile of poop. I should add that the poop is smiling. Was that your idea?
Well, that's actually an emoji, so I can't take credit for it. I actually think that emoji started out as a chocolate ice cream scoop, and somehow over time it's been associated with poop. I like to use it because people don't like to talk about poop, and it's a nice way of kind of setting the tone that it's okay to talk about these things, and it is a little humorous, but it also has huge impacts potentially, and so we need to find ways to communicate across different comfort levels, and I feel that the poop emoji is helpful for that.
Yes, that poop emoji does bring a smile to one's face. I'll include a photo of it on our Washington Grain Commission Facebook page, along with a picture of Wisner. When you visit the page to match the voice with the photo, please do me a favor and follow the Washington Grain Commission as another way to ensure you get weekly updates about the podcasts I post each Tuesday morning. As I listened to Wisner, I recalled my days as an agricultural reporter covering livestock and remembering the importance of consistency in animal rations. The last thing a cattle producer wants is to be switching from one feed to another. It can cause a host of problems, and any change is made deliberately and carefully. Meanwhile, we humans thrive on mixing up our diets, and then we wonder why we feel distressed. What I heard Wisner say is that bread is an essential building block for strong gut health. Many would suggest that whole grain bread, which we ate for all but the last few hundred years, is the superior foundation, but refined grain products have also shown gut microbiome benefits. Whatever you eat, it's clear that Wisner believes bread is among the perfect foods for our microbiome, so help spread the word. Thanks for joining me for episode 154, or what I called Gut Check, How Bread Boosts Our Microbiome. Please join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. In times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our glue, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.